promised in a previous episode, Martin recently furnished me with a box full of Raspberry Pi bits for some hardware prototyping.
You're welcome.
And my prototyping has borne fruit, for I have now constructed my first bookshelf buddy.
Oh, okay.
Does it got the RFID tags, or is it still USB keys for the moment?
It's still USB keys for the moment.
Okay.
So in the interim, I've had a lot of feedback from the community about Tonys and Yotos, and there is all sorts of stuff out there, especially with Tonys. There's a whole project for reverse engineering those, and I have it on good authority from various people that both Tonys and Yotos have an ESP32 chip at their heart.
Mm-hmm.
To Alan's question previously about, does this actually need to be a Raspberry Pi? The answer for me is, yes, it does, because I understand how Raspberry Pis work and how to program them. So that's why I thought this would be an excellent starting point for my first prototype.
Also, you have two shopping bags of Raspberry Pi paraphernalia now.
This always helps. So what I've managed to construct is based on a Raspberry Pi A, which is like a normal Raspberry Pi, but without most of the ports. So it's got one USB port, no Ethernet port. Otherwise, it's a Raspberry Pi 3, which means it's a nice little footprint. And this particular one is in a very nice, rugged, solid case. But crucially, it does have one USB port. And I've got my code running on there. I've running it as a systemd service so that it starts up when the Raspberry Pi boots. And then you plug in the USB stick and it does all of the smarts to read the file from the USB stick, talk to audio bookshelf, and play it out through a speaker, which is plugged into the Raspberry Pi's 3.5mm jack.
Ah, that makes life easier, doesn't it? Yeah.
Okay. So we've heard about how your software has evolved. How much shenanigans were involved in getting your Go application to work on a Raspberry Pi?
Right. So one of the reasons I chose Go is because I thought this would be really easy, because I thought I could just cross-compile the binary and sling it onto the Pi, and I wouldn't actually need to install any Go stuff on the Pi. I'd just run my code. Turns out, not quite as simple as that when you've done things the way I have, because I'm relying for a lot of the heavy lifting of this on libvlc, which is a C library.
Mm-hmm.
And cross-compiling C dependencies in Go, while possible, is extremely non-trivial. And a lot of the guides say probably easier just to compile on the target system. So that's what I ended up doing.
Oh,
I ended
no.
up installing libvlc on a Raspberry Pi and compiling on there. But what that means is I can still produce a binary, which I can then distribute from there.
And last week, a question that came up was about what happens when two USBs are plugged in, and you talked about how it finishes the first book and starts on the second book. I guess you've solved that problem by only having one USB port.
Well, this helps, yes, in this case. The logic is still there to cope. If it's playing something and you present it another book, it'll just ignore that until right. you stop playing the first thing. But yes, one port does make things easier. But other than that, everything else that I did on the laptop works just right on the Raspberry Pi in terms of running FS Notify and it auto mounting and all of that, because essentially it is logged into a desktop session when the Pi boots, because I'm just running full-blown Pi OS at the moment, which also turns out is useful, because if you're running something as a systemd service and you want it to play sound, it helps to have a logged in desktop session, and then you can point it at the Pulse Audio
socket,
thank you. And then it just plays as if it were that user.
So you say you're using a Raspberry Pi A in a rugged case. I think I can remember some of the bits you've got. How does this fit with your sort of goal of getting like a device with a screen and buttons? Like, how much functionality have you been able to get working in this initial Pi prototype?
Well, what I've described so far is as far as I've got, basically. I did have some of the other bits you gave me, which had screens and buttons and seemed like a very good platform to produce not what I'd want as the final system, but a very good proof of concept of having all of those bits available, buttons to go forward and back and a screen to display like the book cover or something. Unfortunately, it turns out that getting third-party hardware running on Raspberry Pis requires knowledge that I lack at the moment. It's not a plug-and-play situation in most cases. There's hardware overlays, whatever those are, and drivers to compile. And most, in the cases I was looking at, a lot of the instructions are for older versions of PyOS, and the instructions don't just work on the current version and things like that. So I might be looking at some other options for those going forwards.
Yeah. There's a popular T-shirt that was produced by Jeff Geerling, who's a predominantly Raspberry Pi YouTuber. And it's popular because it's true. And it reads, "It has been 0 days since I last compiled the Linux kernel."
Yes. This is the thing. I haven't actually got to the point of compiling a kernel, but I think I would need to if I was to get some of these things working. There are other things out there which I'm more familiar with. So I bought some nice buttons from the Pi Hut. I can't remember who they're actually made by, which plug into GPIO pins. And I've done buttons on GPIO pins before. So I'm going to start the next phase of prototyping is going to be getting those buttons working. It'll all be, you know, wires and hardware gore all over the place and breadboards and things like that. But it'll show that it's doable until I can do something a bit more solid in the future. Another thing I'd like to do is figure out a speaker that doesn't require its own power. Because at the moment, if you're plugging into the Raspberry Pi's jack, it has to be amplified from there. Otherwise, it wouldn't be loud enough. So I've got a speaker which has its own battery, which is rechargeable, but that's not ideal if I want it to be some sort of integrated device. And you can get things that, like a GPIO hat thing that provides an amplifier and lets you just then plug in a wired speaker of some generic type. So I might look at that as well. And some sort of display would be nice. I'm not actually too worried about it being a proper screen. Some sort of LED matrix might be nice, because that's what's on the Yoto player. It just has a 16 by 16 LED matrix, and that displays essentially an icon blown up, which looks quite cool.
Right, so pixelated LED, not a 7-segment.
Yeah, so exactly, just like 256 pixels RGB.
Right.
Yes. So that's where I am so far. Also, yeah, other ways of reading the book token. So NFC is an option, but another option is a QR code. I had a few people mention that as a possibility. So I've having a play with some Raspberry Pi cameras and trying to work out if I can actually get them to focus at a near enough distance that you'd be able to sort of within the footprint of a device, have it pointing at a QR code that it could then read, which again, isn't really what the cameras are designed to do. They're designed for like looking out of a window or something like that. So there's some challenges there too. I do have a video of the first Bookshelf Buddy prototype in action and playing a book for real. So I will post that somewhere and link to it in the show notes.
Brilliant.
I have been writing good bots and bad bots.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. One of them was a little while ago. As I say this, it's like 3 months ago, but it's still pertinent. I wanted to downscale my Twitter usage. And one part of that was I wanted to have no followers, as in nobody following me and me not following anyone. It's very easy to unfollow people. You click a few buttons and you can unfollow people, and you can do it en masse. There's ways you can do that fairly easily. But it's a little bit more difficult to force other people not to be able to follow you anymore, because I wanted to just have 0-0. Don't ask why. So I wrote this Python. And when I say I wrote it, I got my friendly neighborhood, excitable intern, LLM, to write it for me. And because this was 3 months ago, the process has changed in the last 3 months. But I just wanted to talk about how I did it then and what I learned and how I would do it differently now, I think. So I know there are third-party tools that can do this. Like before anyone writes in and says, oh, just go to this website and press a button and it does it. I'm not interested in that. I wanted to write something, craft something myself. And I wanted to do it in Python. And I'd heard about Selenium. And I think, Mark, you've used Selenium, haven't you?
Yes, I use it quite a lot for automated testing.
Right. And I thought I could use Selenium to automate forcing people to no longer be following me by pressing the buttons in the user interface, mm-hmm. the Twitter user interface, as if a human was doing it. Now, to do that, it has to be in a web browser and log into Twitter and then navigate to the right place and then press buttons and react appropriately. And it's got to do it about 17,000 times because that's how many followers I had on Twitter.
Just saying.
Well, I don't now, so it's not exactly a humble brag or any other kind of brag. So the excitable intern that I used was Claude, and I've used Claude quite a bit. And I just went to the webpage and I asked it a simple request. Could you create a Python script using Selenium to open Twitter/X followers list? And I gave it the URL and uses the button presses to force unfollow. And the way you do this is you block people and then unblock them. And that force unfollows them, right? And I asked it, are there any other things you need from me in order to start developing this thing? And it said, yes. And it asked me for, I said, do you need the whole HTML? And it said, no, just give me a few elements of the page. And so I started by going to the web page, the Twitter page, and using the web developer tool in the browser to highlight elements and then copy that entire chunk of code, the HTML. And I pasted all that into the chat for a few things, like the login, because I thought, well, it's got to log in first. So I gave it the login and password. And I started off with a thing that when I run it, it would open a browser and successfully log on to Twitter. And I was quite pleased with this because I thought this is a monumental step forward from where I was, which was, how on earth do I do this thing? Then Twitter started telling me I was behaving weirdly and it started asking me for extra information in order to log in. And so I needed to detect this. And I told the LLM what was happening and it said, oh, yeah, that's probably anti-bot behavior.
Hashtag awkward.
Yeah, it was. The irony of me talking to a bot about overcoming anti-bot behavior on a website was quite fun. But I found it was quite straightforward for me to just go to the web page in a browser and copy the elements and paste them in and tell the LLM, this is the logic that I want and here are the things that are blocking me doing that thing. And eventually I got it to a point where it worked. And it would loop through every single one of the people following me and click the relevant buttons in the user interface in order to force them to unfollow me. And I just left that running on my laptop. I had to add a few extra things like delays that were human-like. So I told it, you know, add random delays in between button pressing and typing as well. It typed like a human, as in like not just going and filling in a field, but typing a bit slowly. As if that might help, I don't know. So I was quite pleased that all it took was a couple of questions and me highlighting some elements in the user interface. Now, yes, I probably, in the amount of time I did that, I possibly could have clicked the button 17,000 times myself or just deleted my account. Yes, I could have done all those things as well. But I wanted to learn a bit of this Selenium and how it works. And now I've got a piece of Python that I can read. And I know what it does because I told it what to do. And I kind of have an idea of how to use this in the future. And I found it a super useful way to learn a new thing.
So you told me about your unfollow program because you'd published it on that there GitHub. And I was in the same mind as you were, which is I want to eject myself, but I want to leave a placeholder behind on Twitter to say, this is who I am and this is where you can find me where I care. So I used your tool. What I had to do was use DistroBox to create an Ubuntu container because you have to run a full-blooded Chromium and all the rest of it. And I couldn't be faffed with figuring out how to, you know, repackage your stuff to work in NixOS. So I just started an Ubuntu container and installed all the stuff as you'd written down, or possibly an AI had written down in the readme. And it unfollowed my paltry 9,000 people that were following me, but I got to a zero state Twitter account as well.
So yes, on the subject of the readme, once I got this working, I thought, well, I might as well share it because it works. And I told it the name of the repository I was going to call it, Twitter Defollower or something like that. And I told it my repo name and said, could you write a readme for it? And it just did. And it had all the necessary Python commands to install the dependencies. And I felt like this was partly a learning exercise for myself. I learned a bit more Python. I learned a bit more about Selenium. but also it was a super time-saving device because the README was written. I can write a README. I'm not that daft, but it was just instant. It wrote it for me. And the code I could probably have muddled through, but it would have taken an awful lot longer than me asking the nearby excitable intern. And so I consider that a useful use of my time because I managed to learn a bit and I got something useful out of it at the end.
I found it quite interesting what you said about the detecting bot behavior stuff, because in the edtech community, we've seen a bit of that with people trying to like cheat on exams by having a program log in and click on the answers. And then that sort of stuff we found does show up quite well because you can tell looking at logs, how quickly do you expect a person to take an exam and are they going straight to the right answers all the time? And what are the, we have statistics on exams and, what you'd expect the percentage of people getting stuff right to be within what time frame. And so things do kind of stand out when they're wrong. So it's interesting not only that, that you encounter this sort of thing, but that you were also able to use the same tool to circumvent it.
Yeah, and it kind of surprised me that it was possible. I thought a website like that would have better bot protection. After running for a certain amount of time, it did pop up a thing on Twitter and said, the behavior is a bit weird. Can you please give us your email address or your phone number as a piece of additional credentials? Because when I log in, I use a username and password, and it wanted an extra bit of info that it knew I knew. And so I told the bot to detect for this pop-up to appear, and I told it my email address.
Here's all my personal information.
Yes, yes. And I put them as variables in the Python, and it just inserted them whenever Twitter asked for it. It just did the right thing. And yeah, I was kind of surprised. I know there are other sites that have much better bot detection and protection. And that leads me on to the bad bot that I made. My son is learning to drive. And getting a driving test in the UK is very hard. There's a number of reasons. There have been some articles on the BBC recently about this, but it's you go to a website and you try and get a booking and you can't. They're all gone. And the cancellations are released at like 6 a.m. on a Monday and sometime on a Tuesday. And if you go to the website at that time, it presents you with a little animation of a man walking along a conveyor belt. And it tells you there are 3,000 people in front of you in the queue, right? And it opens at 6 o'clock. And then you log in and you go through the process and you find there are no appointments available. And I know that there are people out there who use bots to do this. And I thought, well, if you can't beat them, join them. And so I started using my newfound knowledge and a little bit of help from the LLM to do exactly that. And I got it as far as signing in, looking for appointments in my local area, navigating through the really janky website that they have for booking driving tests. And then it got stopped because their anti-bot behavior thing blocked my IP address because it was able to detect that I was doing something nefarious. Now, fair enough, it only blocked it for like 24 hours or something, so it wasn't a massive deal. And I am not motivated to keep on developing that. But I found it fascinating that it's actually not that hard to build these kind of bots. So I'm not surprised that websites have such difficulty dealing with bots because creating these things, especially using an LLM, is surprisingly easy. Look forward to more stories of more bots that I'm creating that are doing things automatically for me on websites.
I was out for a walk the other day and quite unexpectedly, out of nowhere, I fell down the custom keyboard rabbit hole.
Oh, dear. Did your wallet fall open and all the money fall out as well?
Maybe. Maybe a little bit.
Not at first.
Not at first, but maybe. So I have resisted the temptation to get into custom keyboards for many years now, because it wasn't so many years ago that if you really sort of got stuck into custom keyboards, you could easily spend £400 or £500 on building a custom keyboard. And I'm not interested in spending that kind of money on a keyboard. But roll forward to the current day, and all of those enthusiasts that trailblazed all of the expense and hard work with lubed keys, switches, and stabilizers, and foam, and packing, and aluminium cases, and different types of key switches. All of those sort of enthusiast level features are now readily available in pre-built custom keyboards, which sounds like a bit of an oxymoron, but they're custom keyboards that are produced by the manufacturers of all of the components that go into a keyboard, but you can buy ready assembled with all of the accoutrements of being able to disassemble it and modify it and change the things about it that you want to change.
So did you buy a ready assembled keyboard?
I did buy a ready assembled keyboard, but I did not buy the ready assembled keyboard that I actually wanted. So this is a bit of a windy story, and this is where I have my first bump as I go headfirst down the rabbit hole. So the reason why I decided to do this is that one of my keyboards was working intermittently. It was suddenly it would all go dark, like I have RGB, don't you know, and all of the lights would go out, and that was my first clue it wasn't working, and then it wasn't responding to inputs. And the keyboards that I had were Razer keyboards, because the last time I refreshed my keyboards, which was, I don't know, 2016 2017, the way to get good quality linear switches was to buy a, in air quotes, gaming keyboard. So that's what I had. And I'll get into why linear switches are my thing a bit later. And so having one dodgy keyboard and some difficulties with OpenRazor getting in the way of kernel and USB activity is also the modern custom keyboards sound delightful. And I do believe the correct term is FOC, is how the modern mechanical keyboard should sound.
FOC.
FOC. Yes.
Okay.
And I wanted FOC in my life. So I'm going to tell you the keyboard that I wanted. And if you're sensible, this is the keyboard you will go for. So I like 80% keyboards. So keyboards are in different sizes.
Oh, not that sensible then.
Well, so Mark, I believe you like the 100% keyboard, which is the traditional sort of PC keyboard that includes the number pad.
Absolutely.
And the 80% keyboard is also known as 10 keyless, which basically means it doesn't have the number pad, but it has the function row and the T-bar cursors and the home insert, end, page up, page down. That's my preference. And the keyboard that I found through research is called the EvoWorks Evo 80, the 80 being the 80%. There's a link to that in the show notes if you're interested. There's a company in the UK that resell those, and they come in an ISO layout, which is if you're in Europe, that's what you want, because that means you can do UK, German, French, Nordic, and all the rest of it, key layouts and all of that good stuff.
I also sometimes use a keyboard that has the 10 keys on the side. I've just remembered the only reason why I use them is because in Grand Theft Auto, you need the keys to be able to fly the plane, and I can't be bothered to reassign the key. So I just plug in a different keyboard that has the 10 keys so I can fly the plane properly.
Hold that thought. I'm going to blow your mind later. So that was the keyboard I should have got. But I didn't get it because it's part of a like group buy thing. So you have to put your pre-order in. Yeah, exactly. And I was not patient enough to do all of that. So I didn't do that. So what I ended up getting is a WobKey, which is the manufacturer, Crush 80, and the 80 being the 80%. WobKey are fairly new. I think they've been around a couple of years. Their first keyboard was the Rainy 75, which is a 75% keyboard. And the Rainy is because the sound profile they were trying to create as you type is the sound of rain hitting a window. So kind of delightful.
And then the sound of this is something being crushed under a heavy object.
No, the reason this is called the Crush 80 is that in the base of the aluminium case is crushed rock to give it heft, weight and gravitas in order to sort of soak up the pings of a mechanical keyboard.
Does that crush gravel not just like get in between the keys and like make a rattling noise as it's, or is it compressed back into rock?
It is compressed into like marble, like you'd find on like a fine kitchen surface. So there is, you turn it over and there is this marble like underlay, crushed rock, polished underlay on the back of the keyboard. It's rather pretty, but it also means that my 80% keyboard weighs 2.5 kilos.
Yes. When this arrived in the office and you went, here you go, look at this, and hand it to me, you weren't careful. And I was not anticipating the amount of weight being handed over. And I was like, oh, God. Yeah, it is a weighty thing. It's way heavier than an IBM Model M, which is my standard measure for heavy keyboards.
Yes, it's definitely a very heavy thing. It's it has that feel to it, like if you pick up lead plating to, you know, put between the tiles on the roof, you're always surprised at how heavy and dense that feels when you pick it up. It's the same sort of sensation. Anyway, all of these pre-built custom keyboards have all of the mod cons. So I mentioned their aluminium construction, they've got gasket mounts, so they've got flex that you can configure to your liking, they have wireless Bluetooth, N-key rollover, and all the rest of it. So it's a delightful keyboard, but the big drawback of the WobKey Crush 80 is that it only comes in a US ANSI layout.
Ugh.
And here is where I take my second tumble down the rabbit hole of custom keyboards, because after trying it for a bit in the US layout, I decided that wasn't for me. So I found a third-party vendor that sells an ISO switch plate for this keyboard. So that means that you can tear down the keyboard, pull all of the key switches out, and put a different, let's call it grid, in place that aligns to a European ISO layout.
So given what you said about WobKey being a fairly new company, how difficult was it to find some other company that made custom switch plates for this exact keyboard by this company? Or is it a fairly standard size which would fit multiple keyboards?
It is a standard size. The 80% is a standard size. I don't know if the switch plate I got is generic or specific to this. I think it's specific because there are some layout stuff, but there is a company called Nuvolo, I think that's their name, and they're in Singapore, and they make all manner of these accessories and kit parts for all of the popular custom keyboards. So other than waiting 2 weeks for it to arrive, it was easy to find and inexpensive to purchase. Once it had arrived, I was easily able to disassemble this keyboard because it has a ball and latch thing. So I didn't have to unscrew anything. You can just unclip the top surface and then you take all the keycaps off. Then you pull all the switches out. Then you take the existing switch plate out, put the new one in. And then you have to do a bit of thinking because you realize, hang on a minute, I have to rotate some of the key switches through 90 degrees or 180 degrees in order to fit the ISO layout. But once I'd got my head around that, it was fine. I had 90 new switches. So I bought some Akko Rosewood switches. So I decided to replace the switches. And the reason for that is I have quite a serious injury to my right hand and I've got extensive nerve damage. So I don't like tactile or heavy keys.
Rosewood is what my guitar fretboard is made out of. Are your key switches made from rosewood?
No, they're not made from rosewood. No, they're made by a company called Akko, who are, I have learned, popular in the custom keyboard community. And this particular switch type is called rosewood, and they are pink, a very delicate pink in colour. And they're a linear switch, so they have no tactile bump, and they only have a 40 gram actuation force with only 1.9 millimeters of travel. So that's good for me because I don't like to type with any heavy pressure because that's extremely uncomfortable on my right hand. So I, having put the new switch plate in and furnished the keyboard with 89 new switches because I broke one, I had managed to rebuild this keyboard from a US ANSI layout to a UK ISO layout and bought a keycap switch of my choosing to go on it as well.
and then you put it on the shelf and never use it, yeah?
No, it's in front of me right now, and it's delightful. In fact, I like it so much, I bought another one and made the same modifications, and I have that in the office. But the interesting thing I learned, and to your point about, is it Grand Theft Auto? Is that the game you were referring to?
Yes.
Is these, let's call them contemporary custom keyboards, have open source keyboard firmware. And they come in two flavors, either QMK or VIA, and sometimes they're a mix. And there's also another one called Vial, which is sort of a superset of VIA. And what's remarkable about these is it doesn't require any drivers or sort of user space software. You can configure the keyboard from the RGB lights to the physical mapping of the keyboards just through a web browser. Now, on Linux, you have to add some UDEV rules in order to grant access to the device to be, you know, written to be programmed. But you plug your USB keyboard in, go to the VIA website, and you upload a JSON file which describes the schematic of your keyboard, and it just appears, and now you can configure everything about it. And one of the features of these firmwares is you can have multiple layers. So conceptually, you can think of that like mobile phone keyboards when you switch between the alpha keyboard to the numeric and symbol keyboard. You can think of those as layers, and you can access these layers on these physical keyboards. So you can have a whole overlay just for
Flying Planes and Grand Theft Auto 5,
without requiring a 10 key.
Don't make me buy one of these things.
I shan't make you buy one. Maybe in a future episode, we'll come back to that. But what I was able to do was use that to reconfigure some of the physical layouts of the buttons. So interestingly, this keyboard has an F13 in the function row, and I have remapped that at a hardware level to the media play pause toggle, which is just a simple change, but you can do far more than that. So I was rather surprised to learn that, you know, these have ARM processors in them and they run custom firmware. It's a little bit sad that the manufacturer of this keyboard doesn't publish the source code to the firmware of their keyboard. So sad face all round there. But many of these other custom keyboard manufacturers do publish the source code and publish it in GitHub. And I've got links to QMK and VIA in the show notes.